to this course. I think many of you have been welcomed already last week and this week, but welcome again. My name is Ingrid Fisk and I work at Summer School. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Greg Fried from the Department of Philosophy at UCT, who will be leading the thought experiment that is this course, Five Great Philosophical Questions. Among many achievements, Dr. Fried is a novelist. I consider this one of his highest achievements, but I believe that some of his other academic ones should take precedence too. He's written a number of novels with his wife, Lisa Lazarus. They write as Greg Lazarus. And a new book will be coming out in May called Paradise, published by Quella. So look out for it in May. He has won many prizes for public speaking and lucidity, such a lovely word, and is engaged in a long-term research project on the philosophical significance of social choice theory. He has a special interest in and has written on the comparison of morally bad systems of decision, with morally good systems. But he teaches across a very wide area, including aesthetics, business ethics, classical political philosophy, the philosophy of mathematics, and the philosophy of mind. Just listen to some of the topics of his presentations, reflecting some of the questions that he engages with. Why should I be moral? Hume on miracles. The liberal paradox. Why beauty is crucial to mathematics. What is a number? Are our words meaningless? And my favorite, love, truth, and the demon. Ideas in Iris Murdoch's novels. And he is a specialist on the meaning of and the roles that humour plays. His dissertation for his PhD at Trinity College at Cambridge was What Theory Cannot Capture, Freud and Four Philosophers on Humour. I envy you the opportunity to hear Dr. Fried apply his rigorous mind, lucidity and humour to five of the great questions we and philosophers have not yet resolved. Please welcome Dr. Fried.
Thanks, Ingrid. I'm thoroughly intimidated now. I like this picture. You may have been looking at it for a while. It looks to me like it's from the Renaissance. Maybe it's some kind of 16th century woodcutting. But actually, it's from a 19th century book by Camille Flammarion, a French book on atmospheric sciences. One reason I like it as an emblem for an introductory course in philosophy is because I think it expresses a philosophical yearning, a yearning to go beyond appearances and to see the nice... Well, to see the fundamental nature of the world. This person in the picture is passing through the world of appearances and discerning the way things really are. And that's really one important motivation for being a philosopher, for studying philosophy. It's lovely to be here. I was here last year and I really enjoyed it. I gave a couple of lectures on David Hume and I found the audience quite rambunctious, kind of obstreperous. It was frightening and exciting. Less polite and more forthright than my students, which was quite thrilling. So it's good to be here again. What I want to do today is to discuss briefly what philosophy is, and then to mention the five questions we're going to talk about this week, and finally to launch into the topic for today, which is St. Anselm's ontological argument. But to begin with, the question is, what is philosophy? Which I want to explore by means of two questions. Firstly, how I, as a philosopher, see myself, and secondly, how my wife sees me. But as a kind of warm-up, as what a philosopher called David Dennett calls an intuition pump, let me ask you what you think philosophy is. What is the subject? Certainly in South Africa, people aren't standardly introduced to it from early on. It's not a subject at school, and not a vast number of students study it afterwards. So it is helpful to ask what it is in a way that we might not if we were doing a course in, say, English or mathematics. What are we doing when we do philosophy? Yes?
something about thinking that has no other recognized label.
Something about thing. Let me take away the something about, because I'm not sure what to do with it. They may be doing something important, but let me take it away for the moment. You're thinking, and you're doing so in a way that has no other recognized label. So presumably, you're doing thinking when you're also doing maths. I mean, you're doing all kinds of other things. I mean, if you're doing a plumbing job around the house, there's thinking too. But this is the kind of thinking that isn't called anything but philosophy. You see, I guess that's... Oh, you're thinking about thinking. Well, hold on, that's a different thing. You know, a very poor multitasker. So I'm just focusing on this first analysis. You're thinking, and it's the kind of thinking that isn't called anything but philosophy. You see, that may well be true, but I'm not sure how illuminating it is. I'm not sure it tells one anything about philosophy except that it isn't called something else. But that is true, and in philosophy we seldom get a truth. So I think that's a good thing. You've got some truth there. Anybody else? Yes?
Dealing with the question, why is there something as opposed to nothing?
That is one question. And you know, people mention that as a standard philosophical question. And it always interests me because it seems dreadfully difficult. And I haven't actually read any philosophical works about it. But that is a good example of a philosophical question. And that, I guess, is one way to understand the field. You understand it by giving a rich set of examples, and that would be a very good one of them. Anybody else with thoughts on what philosophy is? Yes, at the back.
Well, I've just been boring the Kajanshik. It's the Greek, and it means the love of knowledge, doesn't it?
The love of knowledge. Yes.
Wisdom of knowledge.
Yes. The love of wisdom. I mean, I'm inclined to embrace it because it feels so flattering. I think that is an important feature of philosophy. I'm not sure, running as a kind of mental image through the philosophers I know, whether all could be described as wise, even if they are all proficient philosophers. But certainly wisdom seems to be an important goal of philosophy. And you don't become... And it's one important motivation for becoming a philosopher, a love of wisdom. I mean, you certainly don't go into it for the cash. A love of wisdom is really a crucial motive. Any further thoughts? Yes?
It's about a question and an answer, where the question is probably more important than the answer. But sometimes the question is so simple that one asks, well, why are you asking that question? But the answer may be so paradoxical that it's actually quite hard to believe. And I can give an example of the race between Achilles and the tortoise. When you ask the question, who would win the race, Achilles or the tortoise? And the answer is so simple, it's obvious that Achilles would.
Yes.
But in actual fact, if you read the paradox of Zeno, the tortoise actually can prove that he's going to win the race. So it's a question about a simple question with a paradoxical answer.
Yes, I think to pick out one of the strands of your remarks, I think you've made an excellent point. Frequently the questions seem simple in philosophy, and yet the answers are really complex. As we go further and further, our answers become more detailed and nuanced and subtle. And they're prompted by quite simple, disarmingly simple questions. The gentleman's referred to a famous article by Charles Lutwidge Dodgson. That's the real name of Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice in Wonderland and various other books. And Dodgson wrote a well-known article in the philosophy journal Mind, somewhat more than 100 years ago, on Achilles and the tortoise. He identified a paradox. But again, one may think the world is a certain way. It may seem unproblematic, but when one looks at it, it becomes deeper and more subtle the more one examines it. Let me say a few things I have in mind about philosophy. Here's how I see myself as a philosopher. This is by the German, you may know this painting, this is by the German romantic painter Caspar David Friedrich. It was painted in 1818, and it's called The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog. Now, this man is staring profoundly into the unknown, and I like to think of philosophers as being this way because we really do deal with deep questions. In fact, we are interested, I think, in the deepest questions one can ask. I think this is a really striking feature of philosophy. And I put it this way in the course, in the outline, the proposed outline for the course I sent, and it was struck out by an editor. I imagine it was thought to be superfluous, and then I was too sort of ashamed to try and put it back in again. But on thinking about it, I realized that this is an important feature of philosophy. It's not just really deep questions, it's the deepest questions we can ask that philosophers are intrigued by. I mean, of course, you might ask questions that don't really make sense, that cease to be grammatical in your attempt to be profound or deep, but as long as the question makes a kind of sense, philosophers are interested in it if it's really deep. It doesn't matter how deep you go, philosophers are interested in it. In fact, the more profound the question, the more intriguing it is to philosophers. We really do ask questions like, what is the point? What's the purpose of life? Is there a God? What is it to be moral? Is the world as it appears, the world as it really is? Or is the world as it really is quite different? And many of the questions seem quite abstract, but as philosophers, we're also interested in questions with important practical consequences. So philosophers have thought about matters such as whether it's ever justified to torture somebody, what sort of government is best, whether free health care should be given to people whose own actions have brought about their illness. But although these questions do really have very important practical implications, they very soon involve deep reflection. That's what makes them philosophical. So that's how I see myself as a philosopher, an explorer of the deepest questions. How my wife sees me. This is another German painting, this one a little bit less respectful of its subject. This is by the painter Karl Spitzweg. It's called The Bookworm, painted in the mid-1800s. Now here we have this fellow who is lost in his own abstractions. He's staring at one book, he's holding another. There's one under his elbow, there's one between his knees. He's in the section of his library labeled, you'll see towards the top, you'll see a vague label which says in German, Metaphysik. Metaphysics, the most forbiddingly obscure branch of philosophy which deals with the fundamental nature of reality. And there's something a little bumbling and foolish about this fellow, I think, though one can feel fond of him. Because what you might ask is, how can a subject that is so ambitious and really seeks to plumb the nature of reality ever achieve its ambitions when its method just involves reading other philosophers? Because that's what we do as philosophers. Some philosophers strike out and do empirical work of their own, but it's quite fringe still. As philosophers, what we do is we read other philosophers and we think really carefully and we try to say something new. Frequently we say what's wrong with the other philosophers and what's right about our own views. So we don't do empirical work, at least not most of us. Sometimes we may read books by people, journal articles by people who've done the empirical investigation, but that's not what we do. And I guess an important question is, how on earth can we discover anything important about the world if in fact we're not going out to investigate it? I think we do. I think that the philosophical tools, which are as basic as reading other philosophers' arguments and thinking of arguments of our own, right? An argument being a set of reasons in support of some conclusion, has been most helpful. I think philosophers very seldom come to an agreement on a solution to a philosophical problem. So they very seldom get there. But what they have often done is uncover the subtlety and the complexity of the terrain. A problem, a question is said, philosophers after a while can begin to see how complex and subtle matters are. Philosophers have identified a range of answers you could have to a question and thought about the merits and flaws of each of these answers. They've encouraged the questions to become more refined, more sophisticated, and in general, I think a useful term here is illumination. I think philosophy can illuminate a range of topics. There's another point about the nature of philosophy worth making. The philosophy department runs a program called Foundations in Philosophy for high school students. We offer a small philosophy program every year for grades 10 to 12. And on the last occasion, one grade 11 sort of came up to me and she said, do you have an agenda? I felt quite excited. I felt like a political propagandist or a spy. And she said, my father says you have an agenda. So I said, yes. Our agenda is to encourage you to think deeply about profound questions. I mean, that's as far as the agenda goes when the philosopher is doing his or her job. Philosophy doesn't presuppose any particular beliefs, any beliefs about religion or politics or anything else. There's no doctrinal qualification required to do philosophy. And that's one thing that distinguishes philosophy from various other fields. Of course, many philosophers hold views. They very strongly hold views of their own, right? So some philosopher might strongly, to take the God example, which we'll talk about, might strongly believe in God for a variety of reasons. But the point is that one's not required to do so in order to do philosophy. Another philosopher might not. What unifies these philosophers is not their particular doctrines, it's their allegiance to discovering the truth in a reasonable way. It's their allegiance to rational analysis in the uncovering of profound matters. And I guess that's what distinguishes philosophy from various other fields which involve deep thinking. For example, suppose there were a group of Catholic theologians working at the Vatican on various important theological questions, I don't know, to do with the nature of God or the implications of various Catholic doctrines, and I were to apply, and suppose I said, well, look, you know, I don't believe in the Holy Trinity or, you know, God or anything like that. You know, I don't accept any of these doctrines, but I am very interested in them, and I'm quite well-versed in them. I've read a number of books and articles, and here are my thoughts. There'd be something problematic about admitting me, because it seems that one thing that's important for this group is that its members hold certain beliefs in common. That's not the case with philosophy. To be a philosopher, you don't need to believe anything in particular. Okay. Now, I'm trying to avoid the word agenda, so here's the menu for these for these five lectures. I guess it's not really a menu because you have to have everything on it. In this case, you've got to have all five topics. Here are the five famous questions, and I've cheated slightly by not dealing with these questions in their entirety. You're not going to finish the lecture today or whenever I finish the first topic by giving a yes or no answer to the question, is there a God? I'll just deal with one argument. What is the mind? I'll deal with the famous dualism, physicalism debate. Do we have free will? I'll pick out some highlights. What is it to act morally? And what are the scope and limits of free speech? And I've selected these topics firstly because I think they're of relatively broad interest. I mean, I say without shame that my research area in philosophy is of enormously narrow interest. I mean, in fact, I had to go to Rotterdam in June to meet other people who were interested in it. I have to kind of travel across continents to meet other people who find it as fascinating as I do. But these topics have been generally thought to be engaging by a lot of people. So let's launch into the first question about whether there's a God, and I have a particular argument in mind, the famous ontological argument, but to warm us up for this question, we might consider arguments for God's existence. Philosophy of religion was, some centuries ago, absolutely central to the philosophical project, and it was really integrated with just about any other area of philosophy. By the 21st century, philosophy of religion is no longer central to many philosophers' concerns, but nonetheless, a number of philosophers engage in it, a number of really outstanding philosophers. So, although no longer central, it is still a lively field. And the argument I'll be thinking about is nearly 1,000 years old, particularly fascinating one, I think. But I want us first to consider what arguments might be available. So let me ask you what arguments there might be for God's existence. I'm not asking for critiques. So if you think the argument doesn't work, don't raise that, just mention the argument. Does anybody have any thoughts about this? You certainly don't need to be a philosopher to think of these arguments. It's something that many of us think about from childhood onwards. So, does anybody have in mind reasons for claiming that God exists? Yes. The argument from design. Good. And I'll say something about that in a couple of minutes. Really famous central one. Yes?
Mystical experiences.
Mystical experiences. Can you tell me more?
No.
Yes. That's an excellent answer. It's a mystical experience. I mean, people who write about mystical experiences even have a word to describe the indescribability of mystical experiences. They are ineffable. So, I'm afraid we can't explore the mystical experiences. If you've had one, I guess you'll know what it is. Anybody else?
Supposed answers to prayer?
Yes. I mean, if you pray and you get an answer to your prayer, it does appear frequently that the best explanation is that the addressee has answered. Yes? Yes?
Miracles?
Miracles. Kind of a God reaching in and intervening in the natural order of the world. So it may well be that God has set up the natural order of the world, but then he does a little tweak on occasion. Okay. And last one, yes?
Creation of the Big Bang.
Creation of the Big Bang. Let's think. So how would the argument go?
Something came from nothing, therefore there had to be something that created the something from nothing.
Yes.
And that something is a big bang.
Yes. And in fact, to make this argument even more dignified, medieval and Renaissance philosophers had a kind of Latin phrase. They would say, ex nihil nihil fit. From nothing, nothing comes. The conclusion, for instance, of the 17th century philosopher John Locke was that because nothing comes from nothing, there must always have been something. There is something now, so in effect, there must have been some anchor going eternally backwards. If there were ever a gap in existence so that nothing existed, then there would have been nothing forever after that. And that thing which has existed eternally into the past is God. It's a nice argument. My mother-in-law has firmly said yes, so I'm certainly reluctant to offer any criticism now. Fortunately, we won't be discussing that argument today. Let's spend a moment on the design argument, a precursor to the ontological argument, which is quite different from the ontological argument because I think it has a strong empirical component. The design argument is enriched by empirical investigations, and the argument, which has been expressed in various ways by different philosophers, is something like this. When one contemplates nature, and one observes its tremendous complexity, but the order amongst its complexity, the elegance of it, then one should conclude, maybe as the best explanation, maybe even as the only explanation, that there must have been some designer. It makes much less sense, so the argument goes, to say that this simply came about without intelligent design. Here is a picture by William Blake, as some of you will know, of God designing the world. He's using a compass. That's the part at the bottom. There must be some intelligent designer that best accounts for the elegant, ordered complexity of the world. And there's a strong empirical component here because presumably you want to heap up as much empirical evidence as you can find about the flora and fauna and various entities that the universe consists of. Because there's an empirical component in the argument, I guess it's unsurprising that the response has also contained an empirical component, and one way to express the response from the 19th century onwards is that there is indeed a better explanation than the empirical, than the intelligent designer. The better explanation is this natural mechanism of evolution. So that is how the debate goes. And we're not going to discuss that today. I simply wanted to raise it as an interesting argument and a contrast to the ontological argument. I think it's time now for the argument we had in mind. I'm quite happy for us not to finish this today and to go over to tomorrow, and that's because we spent part of today giving an introduction to philosophy. Don't worry, we'll have time for all five questions this week. The ontological argument has been offered by a number of philosophers in different forms, but its originator was a truly brilliant thinker called St. Anselm, an 11th century theologian who later in his life became the Archbishop of Canterbury. He wrote quite prolifically, and the ontological argument, it was called that by Immanuel Kant, appears in a work called Proslogion, which is a word of his own devising. It sounds Greek, but it's really St. Anselm's own term, which appeared in about 1077 or 1078. I think it's quite fascinating, and I think that though it's nearly 1,000 years old, it's still really important to study, not just for historical value, not just because it's quaint to see what people used to believe, but because, at least for some people or in some moods, it has a kind of grip on us. I think there's something really profound about it. So we're going to ask a disarmingly simple question, which is the perfect being real? This is a detail some of you will know from part of Michelangelo's ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. It's a detail from the creation of Adam. I had to have a picture. I mean, it's a shot in the dark, you know, if you want a picture of the perfect being, but I thought this would be okay. Now, is the perfect being real? There are a number of ways you could ask this question. You could say, well, is the perfect being real? Is the perfect being real or merely imaginary or fictional? Or you could say, does the perfect being exist in reality or merely in the mind? As Anselm puts it, merely in the understanding. The perfect being exists in reality or merely in the understanding. And the ontological argument is going to attempt to show that given these two options, existence in reality or mere existence in the understanding, in the mind, we must conclude that the perfect being exists in reality. I'm not going to bother thinking about whether the perfect being is God. I'm assuming that's pretty plausible. If you're convinced there's a perfect being, you're happy to call that perfect being God. I should say that I'm going to simplify the argument. The argument is, the Anselm expresses it in quite a convoluted way. Not that convoluted, but I'm going to keep it quite simple. But I will be expressing it in a way that, though it takes away some of its subtleties, nonetheless gets at one important feature of it. Here's Anselm's thinking. Okay, just for clarity, I'm going to have two graphics. If a thing's imaginary, I'm going to place that little fluffy kind of cloud thing around it. So maybe the perfect being is fictional. That's how I'll express that. And maybe the perfect being is real. There are only these two options. It doesn't seem like there are any others. Certainly, Anselm thinks we can imagine, we have various thoughts of the perfect being. The question is whether our thoughts actually correspond to reality, whether the perfect being is really there. And here comes the truly, shockingly simple argument for the vast conclusion. Anselm says, if the perfect being were fictional, it wouldn't really be perfect. Why? Because there'd be a greater being, a being that was just the same, but real. If the perfect being, right, the greatest possible being, were fictional, it wouldn't be perfect, because it would be less than a being just the same, but real. Don't worry, we'll go into it more carefully. This is a first pass. I thought, given the conclusion, the least it deserves is fireworks. The conclusion is, the perfect being can't be fictional, right? Because any fictional being is not really perfect. There's always a greater being than a fictional one. So the perfect being's real.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, who has defined what this perfect being?
Will, you know, I mean, I admire your philosophical spirit, because as philosophers, there's nothing we love more than to criticize an argument. But I'd like you to hold back until I've just gone through the argument a little bit longer. And then you can tell us what you think is wrong with it. Okay. So let me put the argument, let me put St. Anselm's argument in this form. And again, this is not quite his argument. I've simplified it, but I think it gets the essence of some of the things he's doing. There's an assumption here, which is that actual existence, real existence, confers more greatness on a being than mere fictional or imaginary existence. And I'll say something about that later. St. Anselm doesn't argue for this, it's an assumption of his. The thing really exists. Well, the reality of existence confers more greatness than mere imaginary or fictional existence. If you accept that, then it seems that you need to accept from your assumption, you need to accept that no fictional being is perfect. Why? Because given any fictional being, there could always be a greater one, a being just the same but real. So no fictional being is perfect. No fictional being is the greatest possible being. Well, we've gone from the assumption to line 2, and now we leap nimbly from line 2 to 3. It seems to follow that the perfect being is real. Can't be fictional, because then there'd be a greater one, just the same but real. So the perfect being is real. Okay. Now, I've sort of tremulously written on my slide at this point, criticisms, ? So before I discuss further Anselm's assumption, I'd like some thoughts. Tell me, and there's certainly nothing to be ashamed of here, because many important thinkers have found this persuasive. Who initially thinks there's something to this? Maybe not perfect, but there's something perhaps plausible in this. Okay, well then, I'm assuming that many of you have in mind cogent criticisms. Yes, you had a thought.
If the perfect being is real,
yes,
it presupposes that there's going to be a deterioration of time, too.
Why?
Because if it's an imaginary thing, it can remain the same forever, you presuppose.
Well,
something real. Real.
Now, what's interesting about by the definition of real? Okay, what's by real we need? Okay, St. Anselm doesn't tell us about what counts as real. Presumably, we understand the notion of existence merely in the imagination, right? Dragons and unicorns are like that, and perhaps we understand, by example, existence in reality. Horses are like that. And God, for him, has been shown to be of the latter kind. He's not just imaginary. Maybe you can't see God. Maybe God isn't located in space. But nonetheless, you haven't just imagined him. Now, your point is interesting. You've said, well, if God is real, then presumably there's some kind of deterioration involved. I'm not sure about that. This is the case for familiar physical objects. The cell phone, as fond of it as I am, is not something that's going to exist in 1,000 years. I just have to face up to that. But it doesn't follow that anything that's real is like that. Presumably physical objects are like that. They're subject to various kinds of physical decay. But for example, various philosophers of mathematics think that numbers are real. But not a single one of them thinks that numbers suffer decay. Two may be real, but nonetheless, until the end of time, if there is such a thing, two will be just the same. So, I think if Anselm had attempted to show that God was a physical being like us, he'd be subject to your criticism. But he hasn't. He's just tried to show that God's real. Yes?
You've used greatness and perfect as interchangeable, or greatness as a part of being perfect. But perfect is the complete thing.
Yes.
Completion. So to say that real existence, you can't say it's greater. You've got to say it's more perfect than imaginary existence. And that's the question. Is it more perfect than imaginary?
You know, I too struggle with the terminology here. What I am attempting to find is a comparative whose superlative is the word perfect. Okay. So as something journeys towards perfection, it becomes I want to say greater and greater, but I know that may not be quite right. You want to say more and more perfect, and the reason I was reluctant to do that is because it seems that the term perfect doesn't admit of comparators. The term perfect is the ultimate. You say greater and greater as a thing moves towards perfection. The being is greater and greater. So that's why I use that terminology. If you can give me better terminology than greater, which doesn't amount to just saying more and more perfect, which I don't think is quite satisfactory, then I'm fine with it. But then it just looks like you can replace your terminology in Anselm's argument. The argument remains.
Really, point number two is the assumption is
yes.
No fictional being is perfect.
Doesn't it follow from this first one?
Well, you don't need it to follow. That can be your assumption. No fictional being is perfect. No fictional being is perfect because reality is perfection. Reality is a constituent of perfection. But that's the assumption, that reality is a constituent of perfection.
Well, I'm happy to replace this with reality as a constituent of perfection.
Okay.
Perhaps your formulation is more elegant than mine. I chose it in order to give the sense of comparators, of comparing one thing to another. But if you want to start with yours and go on to two, that's fine. If you want to start immediately with two, I don't think that's a very interesting argument because the move from two to three is less exciting, I think, than the postulation of one and thinking about what follows from that. Anybody who may not have spoken yet who might wish to speak? Yes?
What criteria do you use to arrive at perfect?
Oh, yes. Now,
what was that?
The question was, what criteria do you use to arrive at perfect? Or a similar, though not identical, question is, what are your criteria for comparing degrees of greatness? Well, let's be specific. Why is it that St. Anselm thinks that given two beings, the one that really exists is greater than the one that's just the same but imaginary? Right? Because this seems to be the crucial point. Once you accept this, it's not so easy to avoid the train journeying down to two and down to three. So why does existence confer more greatness than non-existence? Now, Anselm himself is silent on this, and he may be relying on a long philosophical tradition, perhaps going back to Plato, which assumes it. But I think we would like some filling in at this point. So there's two ways I've tried to do so. Let's try and substantiate St. Anselm's assumption, that crucial first point, that existence confers more greatness than mere status as imaginative or fictional being. Well, I thought of two assumptions. The first approach is to say, consider all the fictional beings and then think about the real ones in relation to it. I mean, you can generate fictional beings indefinitely. You can imagine as many as you like. The realm of imaginary beings is extendable as far as you have patience to go. You can make up griffins, that's the guy on the top left. You can think of unicorns, that's the one lying in the maiden's lap. It's apparently the only way to tame a unicorn. And you can go on and on. I mean, there are great dictionaries of imagined beings, of fictional fantasy beings. But there is something special, you might think, that a horse has, which a griffin and a unicorn and a chimera and all sorts of other creatures we might conjure up anytime we want do not have. And the special thing is that it exists. It's in the realm of reality. There's a kind of greatness about a horse that all these creatures, magnificent though they appear to be in the illustration, do not have. A horse is real. That's one way to try to substantiate, I think, St. Anselm's assumption. Let me offer now a second way. And I've got this idea from a recent philosophical article by Gareth Matthews and Lynn Ryder Baker. They use the idea in a very different way, but I've sort of stolen it from them, so I've cited them. Another approach to saying why existence confers more greatness than mere imagined status is to say that only when an object really exists can it have an unmediated influence on the world. Let's compare Superman to Barack Obama. I mean, Superman has all sorts of truly impressive qualities, but there's one thing he can't do which Obama can. Superman can have no direct, unmediated influence on the real world. The only way Superman can have an influence is, for example, if somebody reads a Superman comic, feels inspired, says, I too will save people in distress, I too will work to help humanity, and so on. Superman himself does nothing directly in the world. Barack Obama, on the other hand, despite having less impressive muscles, can act directly on the world, and that's because he has a distinct advantage. He's real. He moves about and acts in the world. This is another way, I think, of attempting to substantiate this idea that real existence confers more greatness than mere imaginary status. Now, is there something wrong with Anselm's argument? We've had some suggestions. I think some of them Anselm could reply to. Some of them would have to be developed and then might offer some plausible criticisms. But a contemporary of Anselm's offers a famous response. And the response is a reductio ad absurdum, a reduction to the absurd. This is a philosophical technique which works in the following way. Suppose somebody offers a certain kind of argument which seeks to establish a particular conclusion. Well, you then use the same argument to generate all kinds of absurd conclusions. If you can do that, then you've offered a reductio ad absurdum, a reduction to the absurd. You've shown that this argument is obviously untenable. Nobody should hold it. Why? Because if you hold it, then you should just as well accept all kinds of absurdities. And this is precisely what a contemporary of St. Anselm, a monk called Guanilo, does. Anselm presented his argument as a response to the fool. He says, quoting the Bible, he says, the fool says in his heart there is no God. And then he offers this work, Proslogion, in response. Guanilo writes a response also in the late 1000s called, I think quite wittily, On Behalf of the Fool, which is a pretty bold thing to write if you're a monk in the late 1000s. Guanilo certainly believes in God firmly, but he just doesn't think Anselm's argument is very, very good. Now, I'm going to offer to you as a kind of piece of homework, or if the word homework is chilling and distressing to you, just something to chew on. I'm going to offer to you the very first bit of Anselm's argument, and you finish it for when we meet again tomorrow. And Guanilo says, Guanilo's argument. And Guanilo says, okay, well, suppose we like Anselm's method of arguing. Now we can ask the question, does the perfect island exist? I chose a picture of an island. This is St. Lucia in the Caribbean. I mean, I don't know if it's perfect, but it is very nice. So it looks lovely. So this is what I chose. Does the perfect island exist? And Guanilo is going to use Anselm's method of argument in an attempt to show that, ludicrously, if you accept Anselm's argument, you must also accept the existence of the perfect island, which seems silly. We're going to pick up with that tomorrow, and then we're going to go on to a really famous debate about the nature of the mind, which is not just a debate in psychology, a debate about a particular piece of us, but really has fundamental significance. The significance is, what kinds of creatures are we? And the implications are vast, because your views on this are going to determine, for example, whether it's possible to have life after your bodily death, whether it's possible to live on when your body is no longer doing so. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you very much.
I'm a lawyer, don't.
I think it might be. Well, is it within time and space, correct? So he doesn't purport to show that God exists in space. He just purports to show that God is real.
Okay. No, I'm not that God is not outside time.